session number 18467, Reel 2.
Colonel Griffith, Reel 2. I think the Second World War was declared whilst you were in Razmak.
Yes, we were out on operations at the time, as a matter of fact. And so we just carried on with the operations we were engaged on, which at the time was beating up a local tribe because they had severely mauled one of our columns. And I think they had kidnapped a local woman or something like that. This was what gave rise to a lot of it. And we went, took the field in order to show this tribe that they couldn't behave like that. And they decided to engage us with small arms fire. And this turned suddenly from what had been originally a single column coming out from Razmak into a much larger show with troops coming out from Banu as well, and converging from three angles onto this tribal area in order to subdue them. I had not been on the original engagement because I was on leave with my parents at the time. But as soon as I heard that they were taking the field, I set off and joined them in the field. And so I managed to see the whole of the latter part of that operation.
Can you describe what you saw?
This is the funny part of it. You saw damn all. Because I've known a case where we spent a whole day guarding a certain part of a road and saw nobody move at all. And yet we were beaten up as we left that place from a chap who was within about, 70 yards of where we were. He'd moved to that position through the day without letting us know that he was in the field at all. They were incredibly agile in their movements. And, of course, their costume merged into the countryside extremely well.
Why were the Pathans attacking British forces?
For various reasons. At the lowest, it was simply because they were bored. To give you an idea of their mentality, when the engineering department were building roads through Waziristan, as you would expect, proper road engineering group, they put up proper cement signposts, which the locals then used as targets for target practice. So the military, MES we used to call them, the military engineering services, being psychologically intelligent, put up large notices on corrugated sheets of iron, which the locals found were not worth shooting up. It was too simple. There was no fun puncturing holes in sheets of corrugated iron, whereas knocking a cement post to bits from 200 or 300 yards away could be quite amusing. And they would do that to a column for the same reason. They would just go and shoot it up just for the hell of it. Sometimes they had a grudge. There's one famous case, for instance, where a certain battalion was guarding a post. It was a platoon picket on a Narai on the Banu Road. This picket used to be occupied for, I think, probably a fortnight or 3 weeks at a time. And then one day, they were very badly beaten up by the local people. And none of us could think why. Everything had been peaceful, there was no reason for it. And then somebody, I don't know who, came up, they said, "Don't you know that this particular regiment had beaten up that local tribe there?" And he said this had happened some 30 years before. And the local tribe weren't going to forgive them for that. They were just taking their buddy, their revenge. So there were all sorts of reasons for shooting at people.
But did they attack British forces because British people were foreigners?
Not to my knowledge, no. I never heard of a case like that. Nor can I recollect any case of British people being shot at to the exclusion of others. No, I'd say no to that.
What's a Narai?
A Narai is a pass.
So when the Second World War was declared,
yes,
what was your attitude then towards your own personal future?
Well, we had a full-time job on hand, you see. We were on active service and had been for several weeks. So we simply continued. I'm bad on my dates. I can't remember when it happened, but sometime round about then, I was ordered to go to the Staff College in Quetta, where they were training people on short courses to produce the extra demand for staff officers for this war. And instead of being, I think, 3 years, the course was done in one. And I did my course there. But there again, I was at loggerheads, rather. I had rather bloody-minded service in many ways. We had what we call TEUTs, tactical exercises without troops. And I remember going to one where we were in a sitting around a large sand table on which were poised different groupings of, it was a military situation. And we were given a situation where troops were opposed to the enemy, of course, who was Germany at the time. And the question posed was, how do we use our armored corps and in those days in the desert? I knew nothing about desert warfare, mind you. Perhaps this is why I posed the question, but in the desert, they used to group in lagers at night for security reasons. And then operated by day. And I wanted to know, why the hell don't they go and make a move by night? It's the last thing they're going to expect you to do. Well, of course, in the latter stages of the war, that's just what they were doing. But we hadn't freed ourselves from the old thinking of the army. We hadn't been flexible enough. And I don't know who produced the required flexibility in the end, but it was necessary. Some original thinking had to be done, and I don't know where it was going to come from.
What response did you get to your question?
Well, I don't think they bothered to answer it. It wasn't considered a serious question, I think.
What rank did you have when you were at Quetta?
I was a captain. Yes, I must have been a captain then, I think. And I was posted from there to my first staff job as a major.
What staff job was that?
That was in the staff duties branch in headquarters Iraq Force, Baghdad.
What happened whilst you were there?
Hmm?
What happened whilst you were there in Baghdad?
As far as I was concerned, precious little, except the one big advantage of being in staff duties was that we knew everything that went on. All the different departments had to send us copies of their instructions, and our job was to see that there was the proper liaison between the departments. And so we used to check up as to whether Q knew exactly whether the G branch knew that a certain thing was going on, and organize dates and things like that. And although I was a very lowly rank, I dealt with a lot of visiting people coming through. And I can't remember how long I stayed there.
There had been an attempted coup by a chap called Rashid Ali in Baghdad.
Rashid Ali, yes.
Did you go after that attempted coup?
Let me say, I can't remember being influenced by it at all.
Sounds as though you were there afterwards, after it had been put down.
I think that must have been before he started his machinations.
Well, that was actually in June 1941.
Was it? Oh, well, it must have been well after, mustn't it? I can't remember. I can't remember what he did.
Any incidents that happened to you in Baghdad?
I'd have to check on my notes on that as to when I went there. I've probably got it written down somewhere.
But can you recollect any incidents that
happened
to you in Baghdad?
Any incident? There were no major incidents.
Which particular individuals were you working with in Baghdad?
Not sure if his name was Tukar, Brigadier Tukar. He was an elderly brigadier who didn't stay very long out there. He was a very experienced officer, I may say, but belonged very much to the old school.
How did you like working as a staff officer?
I enjoyed it on the whole. I was living in one of the hotels sharing a room with a very old friend of mine, Hayuddin, with whom I had been at Sandhurst. We used to, of course, used to call him Ganga. Ganga Hayuddin. And he was in SD with me. We worked so damned hard, actually, there was not much time for anything else. I remember one entertainment only that we had, and that was when the Russians came down. They had come down through where? Persia, down to Habaniya. And one night they turned out a Russian concert in Baghdad. And that was a superb show that I managed to go to. But otherwise I can't remember anything else.
What did you do after this job?
After this job I was posted as brigade major to 125 Brigade upriver. And unfortunately, almost as soon as I joined them, I went down with jaundice and spent the first several weeks just living in a tent, unable to do anything.
This is in Upper Iraq?
Yes. It took me many weeks to recover from that.
So did you eventually take your job with 125 Brigade?
I didn't do that very well. I did go out into the desert with them, and we did one or two columns into the desert, practice operations. And then I went down to Habaniya, and from there we went across the desert by Nairn transport and were followed by the brigade into Syria up to Damascus. And this was in preparation for an anticipated advance by the Germans.
That sounds as though it would be about 1942 when the Germans were threatening
about then, yes. We went up there just as a brigade headquarters, advanced brigade headquarters group. A few of us really carrying out reconnaissance in the foothills. While the rest of the brigade stayed in Damascus. And they were there during the period that de Gaulle came out, because I remember him visiting the French troops there and trying to pretend that there weren't any British troops or Indian troops there at all. It didn't worry us unduly, but he was a bit haughty. But it was I who had to organize the ceremonial parade on Bastille Day that marched past de Gaulle.
That must almost certainly have been July 1942.
Yes. That was pretty well my swan song, I think, with that brigade. As I say, I was not very efficient, and I don't think I did my job awfully well. And I went from there afterwards, luckily, to the Mountain Warfare Training Center, to their mountaineer wing in the Lebanon, which was a wonderful job. It was a grade 2 staff officer job under a Colonel Thompson, who came from, I think, would it be the York and Lancs Regiment? He was a very fine, keen officer. Full of enthusiasm. And we collected there a hugely mixed bunch of officers. God knows, we must have had, I should think, probably about 12 different nationalities in our staff there. Anyone who could climb a rock or ski or abseil would be recruited. And we used to train troops with a view to setting troops ashore in Crete and places like that by the back door, where they could go and make raids against German outposts. And we were also, in fact, training a Gurkha regiment for dealing with the casino area. This never took place in the end, but we did all the preliminary training. And to produce what we used to call a mountaineer battalion, and to get enough men who were fit enough for the job, I think we used 2 Gurkha regiments. And that had its light side too. They came through in groups using the Lebanese foothills. None of them are really serious mountains or anything like that, but they do come up to 3,000-4,000 feet above sea level, and they had some quite severe climbing there as well, and their winters could be severe. And I'll remember one occasion where one of our biggest rock climbers became very frustrated with the agility these Gurkha troops showed, that he set out one day deliberately to confound the Gurkhas. And he went and searched for the rock climb which, in his opinion, demanded somebody with the longest possible reach. And he went up this climb at the head of a string of about probably 3 Gurkhas and sat at the top, and he got a flick on the rope and he said, "Come on up, coming up, Sahib." And he heard a bit of scuffling going on, and he thought, "Well, my golly, I've got you now." And then, to his fury and amazement, little bobbed head appeared above the rock and said, "Tikai Sahib?" As this chap appeared, having found extra toe and hand holds, you see, which this other chap hadn't spotted. But they were damn good, those Gurkha troops.
What does Tikai mean?
Is all well.
Were you doing an administrative job, or were you actually training?
I was a staff officer. I was doing a staff job. It was my job to see that all the programs were produced correctly, that everybody had the right notes for the next job they were going to do, that the thing functioned well as a unit, as a whole. Because when you think of it, all those mountaineering and rock climbing people, they were not, shall I say, fully trained army officers. They weren't used to military discipline. They needed a little bit of regimenting, which it was my job to provide.
Were you also training SOE agents there?
Was I?
Training Special Operations Executive agents?
I wasn't, no. I was merely what I would call a pen pusher. But whenever I could, I used to go out with one of the instructors and either ski or climb or do whatever I could when I could get away from my desk. But my main job was pen pushing.
This sounds as though it must be about 1943.
Must have been, yes. Mm. Well, I can't remember how long I spent there. I think probably after the landings had been made in Italy. I think there were two schools of thought. I think there was a school of thought probably based broadly in the Middle East who wanted to do these, shall I say, backdoor operations. But there were also the people with a larger operational outlook who were concentrating more on what I would call fully functional, proper military operations. And the two finally had to separate. And as the attack on Italy developed, the other things became more of a sideshow. And so the Mountain Warfare Training Center ceased to be of such importance. We did quite a lot of training of people like the SBS and the LRDG, of whom you will have records. They used us whenever they could to pick our brains how to carry out certain kinds of attacking operations. From there I went to to join my battalion, the guides, who were in Persia guarding the Trans-Persian Railway, carrying supplies to Russia. But in fact, I went as brigade major to their local brigade, which was a very nice posting.
In Persia?
In Persia, yes. By this time, I was much more confident as a brigade major. I had a clearer idea as to what I was expected to do, and enjoyed doing it. And when we weren't organizing